You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Thank you.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having anything to do before the Honorable Beverly Cannoni, Justice of the Superior Court, holding in Dedham within and for the County of Norfolk. Draw near, give your attendance, and you shall be heard. God save the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This court is in session. Please be seated.
Good morning, counsel. Good morning, Ms. Reed.
Good morning, jurors.
This is great. This may be the earliest we've got started, so I appreciate everybody being ready to go right away. I do have to ask you those questions. Was everyone able to follow my instructions and refrain from discussing this case with anyone since we left yesterday?
Yes.
Everyone said yes and nodded affirmatively. Were you also able to follow my instructions and refrain from doing any independent research or investigation into this case?
Yes.
Everyone said yes and nodded affirmatively. Did anyone happen to see, hear, or read anything about this case since we left yet?
No.
Everyone said no or shook their heads.
Thank you. Mr. Brennan, your next witness, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Commonwealth calls Yuri Buchanan.
Please, the clerk.
You solemnly swear the evidence to the court and jury of the case now and hearing to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
Thank you. Take this.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, Mr. Brennan, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Could you please introduce yourself to the jury and spell your last name for the record?
My name is Yuri Buchanek. My last name is spelled B-U-K-H-E-N-I-K.
Mr. Buchanek, where do you work?
I work for the Massachusetts State Police.
What is your role with the Massachusetts State Police?
I'm currently assigned as a sergeant with the Norfolk District Attorney's Office in the Homicide Section.
I want you to take us back before you became a state police trooper with the Norfolk County District Attorney's Office. Where were you born?
I was born in Lviv, Ukraine.
Did you immigrate?
Yes.
How old were you when you immigrated?
I was 9 years old when my family moved to the Boston area.
Did you attend public schools?
Yes.
Through high school?
Yes.
Tell us what you did after high school.
After high school, I enlisted in the United States Marine Corps.
Why did you enlist in the Marine Corps?
It was right after 9/11, and my friends and I...
Go ahead.
My friends and I decided to serve in the nation's armed forces.
Did you serve in the Marine Corps?
I did.
Did you go through training?
I did.
Did you learn any skills?
My specialty was military police, and I attended the military police school at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri.
Through your military service, did you receive top secret clearances?
Yes, my first duty station was with Marine One Presidential Helicopter Squadron. The duty station requires a top secret Yankee White SCI clearance. And as a result, I attained that clearance and held it throughout my career.
Did you engage in any special assignments?
The Presidential Helicopter Squadron is a special assignment. We provide security for the presidential helicopters and presidential assets. With that clearance, we are read into a SCI program, which is a need-to-know basis type situation.
How long were you in the military for?
4 years.
When you discharged from the Marines? What year?
2006.
Honorably discharged?
Yes.
After you were honorably discharged from the Marines, what did you do next?
I had a passion for law enforcement, and I wanted to serve my community here in Massachusetts. So I left California and came home and applied for various police departments, ultimately getting a job with the VA Hospital Police here in the Boston region.
When did you transition from the VA to the Massachusetts State Police? What year?
I actually transitioned to the Attleboro Police Department. I worked there as a patrol officer, SWAT team member, and then in 2011, I transitioned from Attleboro to Massachusetts State Police.
When did you join the homicide unit?
It was May of 2015.
And have you been in that position since?
I have.
And you're now a sergeant in that?
I am.
I want to ask you about the structure of the homicide unit for the state police. How many different troopers work in the homicide unit at Norfolk County DA's office?
We have a range from 2 to 6 troopers working in the homicide section over the years that I've been there. Currently, we have 6 homicide detective troopers in the section.
What type of cases does your unit investigate?
Our unit investigates primarily unattended deaths. Unattended deaths are those that are not attended by a physician. A variety of deaths, including natural deaths of old age, medical conditions, accidental industrial accidents, obviously homicides, overdoses. We have suicides as well. And those vary in age on the victims that pass, whether they're stillborn infant deaths, children that pass away of SIDS, or unfortunately teenage suicides.
Have you been to a number of scenes, a number of cases?
Yes, I have.
Do you handle more than one case at a time?
Yes, we do.
When a case, an unintended death, is notified to your office, is that routine or is it by statute?
The notification comes in due to the statute requirement. In Massachusetts, under Mass General Law, Chapter 38, Section 4, the authority is given to the district attorney in each county to investigate those deaths. They appoint designees, and within Norfolk County, those designees are law enforcement agents from the Massachusetts State Police. So in our county, the Massachusetts State Police, with the district attorney's authority, investigate all unattended deaths.
You mentioned that it's called the homicide unit. Are many of the deaths that you investigate not homicides?
Primarily, the death investigations are not homicides.
When you walk into a call, do you have a preconceived notion whether it's a homicide or not a homicide?
When we walk into a call, we take in all the evidence, so we do not know exactly what we're going to have as a finding. We follow the evidence, we follow the information that we're provided, that we learn throughout the investigation. At times it's obvious that it was a homicide when the local agency that's reporting the death says that there was a shooting reported and there's a, you know, a deceased person at the scene. So yes, we will know that it's most likely a homicide, but we don't make a preconceived notion or determination before we get there.
You said there are a number of cases that go through your office. Do you work investigations by yourself?
Never, no.
Are investigations assigned to the group as a whole or as a particular trooper in the unit?
We have case officers, and the assignment of the responsibility when you will most likely be a case officer is scheduled a month or so in advance. So each trooper has a responsibility of a 24-hour period that they are on call. They respond to the scenes, whether it be a train strike versus pedestrian or a vehicle or a suicide by hanging. They respond, and then if they need assistance or they think that there's something more, additional resources are called out, like crime scene services, which helps us document scenes, et cetera.
Have you ever been assigned a homicide or a homicide investigation?
Yes.
In the cases where you're assigned, do you investigate the case alone?
Never. It's always a team effort. Every case requires a team effort. Just the amount of work that goes into collecting evidence, interviewing witnesses, interviewing involved parties, interviewing the suspect, all those tasks that are required in collecting surveillance footage require manpower and time and resources. And so every investigation, although it has a case officer, it requires a team effort of individuals to work together in concert to accomplish a successful investigation.
Are you often working on more than one investigation at the same time?
Yes, we are.
If you were the case officer, would you have other resources you would use to help with the investigation, other units in the Massachusetts State Police or local police?
Yes. Typically, we partner up with the local police detectives. And when we're conducting interviews, it's a state trooper and a local detective that are conducting those interviews or collecting surveillance footage and so forth. And that there's a reason behind that. The reason why we pair up is not just the manpower, it's also that we work in a dangerous line of work, and people could lose their life, people could get injured, or unfortunately people could get fired or retire and no longer be available to testify, provide their testimony, or be a resource in the future.
Is it a common practice that when there is an investigation, more than one trooper will appear at many events?
It is very common and preferred. Unfortunately, in the real world, it's not always possible. A trooper can be responding to a scene and just to simply grab something from another trooper and could be approached and a small brief interview could happen, or if a trooper's at a home talking to a witness and others show up and willing to provide information, he has to conduct that interview by himself because of the resources aren't available for him.
Let's talk about the assignment of this case. You said that there's case assignments, a schedule that is made in advance?
Yes, sir.
On the day or the morning of January 29, 2022, do you know who was assigned to take calls for new cases?
Yes. Before 7 a.m. on the 29th, it was Michael Proctor that was assigned to be on call.
Is there a supervisor assigned as well, in addition to a trooper that's not in a superior position?
Yes. Every day there's a supervisor assigned in addition to the on-call trooper. There's a supervisor that's also available for any reason at any time to respond, assist that trooper if there's any questions or issues that come up.
Was there a supervisor assigned that morning?
Yes, there was.
And who was that?
It was myself.
When did you first hear or learn anything about this call or this case?
In a unique fashion, this call actually came from the Troop H headquarters, which is the field services portion of the state police, the uniformed patrols that service the Metro Boston area. The headquarters duty office contacted me, I think by mistake, misdialing the number because our names and numbers were listed one above the other. So the call actually came into me. I took the call and advised them that I would call the on-call trooper for that day, and they would contact Canton PD and take the appropriate steps.
About what time did you receive a call that morning?
Approximately 6:44 in the morning.
After receiving the call around 6:44 that morning, did you contact anybody to assign a case manager, or did you get involved personally?
I called Michael Proctor and told him to reach out to Canton and follow up on the report of a male in a snowbank.
And this is around 6:44 a.m.?
Yes, sir.
What did you do next?
I waited for a call back from Michael Proctor, and he reported the details of, yes, there was a male found in the snowbank in Canton, and that they were requesting our assistance as he had sustained injury and was unresponsive and had been transported to Good Samaritan Hospital.
What was the plan at this point?
At this point, where I learned that he had sustained injury and there was a heavy blizzard in the area, I decided myself to get dressed, shovel out, and respond to Canton.
Were you required to get involved and go to Canton that morning?
At this point in time, I was not, but I thought that it would be prudent on me to, at the very least, shovel out, because another call could have come in and I would have had to respond to that and the driver would have been shoveled.
Were you in touch with Mr. Proctor?
I was.
Did you have any plan to meet him?
Yes.
When and where?
We decided to meet at the Canton Police Department.
Okay. And about what time were you going to leave your home, or did you leave your home?
I left my home probably around 8:50, and I know I arrived to the Canton Police Department approximately 9:15 in the morning.
Did you know the address where the person was found in the snow?
At that time, I learned the address once we got to the police department, but it had no significance for me. I did not know where it was.
Why did you plan to go to the Canton Police Department instead of going to the scene first?
The Canton Police Department, fire department personnel and paramedics had already cleared the location. So we, again, given the conditions, we were in a controlled environment inside a police station to exchange information, collect any evidence if it was available, and the police department safety and security of that would have been the best location for it.
You mentioned that you arrived at the Canton Police Department around 9:15 a.m.?
Yes, sir.
Was Mr. Proctor there when you arrived?
Mr. Proctor was there walking in with me.
When you went in with Mr. Proctor that morning, who did you meet?
We went in, we met with multiple Canton Police personnel, one of which being Sergeant Good. He was one of the first responders to the initial scene.
Did you receive any items from Sergeant Good or any of the police officers while you were there?
Yes, we were shown a broken cocktail glass, bottom of a broken cocktail glass. We were provided Mr. John O'Keefe's cell phone, and I was also shown a brown paper bag with six plastic Solo cups in it, containing a what was reported to be a blood in the snow.
When you were shown these items and had a discussion with the Canton Police Department, were any decisions made about the future of the investigation? You had shared with us earlier that typically the state police pair up with local detectives. Did you do that morning?
That morning we did not. We had learned that there was a loose familial connection through town channels with the address and possibility of a Canton police officer or detective. So Canton police, out of overwhelming precaution of impropriety, not that there was one, decided to step away from any interview investigation assistance with us.
Has that happened in your career before?
Yes, it has, yes.
Since there would be no local detective, did that change your role at this point in the case, your involvement?
It did not change my involvement, but it did bring up a concern of manpower. We are obviously limited by staff. The weather conditions also further exacerbated that issue. So transportation was an issue, timing's always an issue, and you can never have enough manpower.
Did your role become more prominent given there was no local detective involved?
I would have to pick up the slack. I'm a team player. I always want to assist in any which way I can to make others life easier.
And you were Mr. Proctor's supervisor?
I was.
After you received the broken glass, the cell phone, and you saw the plastic cups with the blood in them, where did the evidence next lead you?
Based on the information we had learned and the evidence, we decided that we needed to speak to the individuals who were last in contact and present at the scene when Mr. O'Keefe was found.
Did you have any specific other information that you were following at that point?
Yes, we had statements made by the defendant that she was questioning whether she had hit him, and to that extent.
Had you focused in on a target at this point or reached any conclusions about your investigation?
No, we were still in the information and fact-finding portion of the investigation. We are not ruling out people as much as, we're not ruling people in as much as we're ruling people out. So we need to get as much information as possible that is in physical form, statement form, and circumstantial factors as well.
So where did the evidence take you next?
Following three interviews conducted in Canton with witnesses, we proceeded to the Good Samaritan Hospital because, based on the information I learned, I needed to put eyes on Mr. O'Keefe and his injuries. I needed to see what exactly the witnesses were describing.
Do you remember who you spoke with that morning before you decided that you wanted to go to the hospital to see Mr. O'Keefe?
Yes, we interviewed Ms. Jen McCabe, Mr. Matt McCabe, and Mr. Brian Albert at the McCabe residence.
How long, or about what time did you get to see Mr. O'Keefe?
We got to see Mr. O'Keefe, I would approximate probably like 12:30, maybe 1 o'clock-ish in
Why
the
did
afternoon.
You want to see him specifically?
I wanted to see the injuries for myself, the location of the injuries, the types of injuries, the extent of the injuries, and overall condition that his body was in would be very telling, the mechanism of injury, how it might have taken place, and also the correlation of any evidence at the scene with those injuries.
Now, you don't have any medical degrees, do you?
I do not, no.
How about biomechanical engineering?
No.
Do you have life and job experience in these situations?
Yes, 20-plus years of law enforcement investigating car crashes, pedestrian crashes, and 10 years in homicide.
Your role is not to make a diagnosis, is it?
No, it's not.
Is this information and your interpretation based on your experience important in guiding what you're going to do in the investigation?
Yes, it is, very.
Do you ultimately get to Good Samaritan Hospital?
Yes, we do.
Okay, take us through what happens when you get there.
When we got to Good Samaritan Hospital, the driving conditions were treacherous. It took us 45 minutes from Canton Center, basically, to Good Sam, which should be a 15-20 minute drive. At one point, I had to get off the highway because I couldn't tell if I was on the roadway, if I was off the roadway. So the guidance of trees on the side of the road through the town streets actually helped us guide the path to Good Samaritan. Once we arrived, we walked to the emergency department where Mr. O'Keefe was initially treated and where he remained. Upon arrival, we spoke with medical personnel who advised us that the defendant had at that point been discharged from the hospital and that Mr. O'Keefe was still in the emergency room and available for us to view.
At that point, you said the defendant had been discharged. She was not the defendant at that point.
No, she was not, no.
Did you have a chance to enter a room or actually see Mr. O'Keefe?
Yes, I did.
Had he passed at that time?
Yes, he has. So
when you walk in the room, what do you see?
When I walked into the room, I saw a medical bed in front of me. Mr. O'Keefe was covered with a sheet, as is typical with any victim that had passed. There was a pile of clothing to the left, at his feet to the left of the bed. I observed several injuries on him once I lifted the sheet, and those were documented with photographs by Crime Scene Services, a member of the state police, who also met us at the hospital for that purpose.
So there were other members of the team that were there to photograph?
Yes.
Mr. O'Keefe and some of the injuries?
Yes.
How many people were in the room with you and Mr. Proctor when you were observing and viewing Mr. O'Keefe?
There was a total of three of us, myself, Mr. Proctor, the crime scene services individual. There was medical staff coming in, nurses asking us if there was anything that we needed to assist us with. But from law enforcement, it was three of us there.
Now, I don't want you to try to give us a diagnosis or provide us an opinion of the cause of any injuries, but rather I want you to share with us, as you're observing Mr. O'Keefe in that hospital room, what are you seeing and what is standing out to you?
I saw pooling of blood underneath his head. There was seepage of blood into the sheets. There was also swelling, discoloration, a large amount of blood pooling underneath his eyelids. There was no abrasions or injuries that I observed to that region, to me, through my training experience. I took that as a
not to any medical observations, but just you as law enforcement.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'd ask you not to give your personal interpretations of what you saw. Rather, I want you to share with the jury what you saw through your view.
There was also a tiny cut, laceration to the eyelid area.
You're pointing to your right eye. Could you be specific, please?
Also on the left nostril, there was a very, very small laceration there. Both were not actively bleeding. There were a series of cuts and bruises to the right arm, which extended from approximately mid forearm up to the mid tricep area of Mr. O'Keefe, and they were concentrated on the exterior of the arm. There was no other injury or marks on the interior or inside of the arm. There was also a bruise on that same arm, on the back of the hand. It was light in color. It wasn't a profound discoloration as the eyes appeared to me. There were also injuries to abrasion or cut scrapes to the knee, I believe.
Which knee?
The right knee. I apologize.
You had first described swelling in the right eye, and then you had just said the eyes. Could you be specific? Was the swelling in one or both eyes when you saw Mr. O'Keefe?
When I saw Mr. O'Keefe, the swelling was in both eyes. It might not have been exactly symmetrical, but there was swelling, discoloration in both eyelids of Mr. O'Keefe. There was also blood pooling in the cavity of the eyeball, both sides of the eyeballs.
Do you know about what time it was that you visited Mr. O'Keefe and made these observations?
It was sometime between 12:30, 1 o'clock, and 2 o'clock, I would assume.
You mentioned that there was pooling on the back of Mr. O'Keefe's head. Did you look for any injury?
Yes, we looked for injury. All I could tell, there was bleeding happening. I could not tell exactly what the extent of the injury was, not being a medical professional.
You mentioned there were a pile of clothes in the floor. Is that uncommon?
No, it's not uncommon at all.
Did you have any opportunity, or did you decide to look at those clothes?
Yes. What happens, the reason those clothes are on the floor is that for medical therapy, for medical treatment. The victim has their clothing removed for access to the body. There's obviously all sorts of equipment and medical procedure that's done. So that clothes is discarded. We knew that it was Mr. O'Keefe's clothing. We knew that it would be important to aid us in the investigation. So that clothing was picked up, identified item by item, and bagged. It was in a soaking wet state with moisture and other debris on it.
When you are looking at Mr. O'Keefe, do you have to touch him and move him?
Yes. During our investigations, we're not simply looking at photographs. We are there in the scene. We are smelling it. We are touching it. We are, unfortunately, with certain pungent scenes, we were tasting it. That's the reality of us breathing in the scene when we're living it through the investigation.
Do you wear any type of protection?
Absolutely. We wear gloves. At times, we wear other PPE, personal protective equipment.
When you looked at Mr. O'Keefe's clothes, you said that you bagged them. Did anything stand out in particular about his set of clothing?
In particular, we were missing a sneaker of his. That was very significant to me. It caused me to have Michael Proctor contact the paramedics that transported Mr. O'Keefe to the hospital and confirm with them, conduct a secondary check, that that sneaker was not left behind in the ambulance.
Why was the missing sneaker significant to you at that point?
At that point, our theory had evolved to a vehicle strike based on the injuries, and I was suspecting that he was hit out of his shoes.
Is there a phrase that's common in these type of situations?
Yes.
And what's that?
Knocked out of your shoes.
Did you know where the other sneaker was?
I did not, no. But I suspected, since it was missing, and once the reports came in that paramedics, EMT personnel did not find the other sneaker, that it would be somewhere where Mr. O'Keefe was found or where he was initially struck by a vehicle.
Did you and Mr. Proctor have an opportunity around that time, 12:30, 1 o'clock, to go back to that address to look for the sneaker?
We did not know.
Why not?
Again, during the critical early hours of an investigation, timing is essential. We have to make sure we get to any and every location that could possibly have evidence and prevent that evidence from being destroyed, altered, or concealed. So we are prioritizing missions. And with the resources available at that time, I conference with my boss and advised him of the current status of the information that we had, and he stated that he would go out and marshal up resources to conduct a search.
Is this an example of the team approach of the state police at the homicide unit?
Objection.
Yeah. After having this information, making these observations of Mr. O'Keefe yourself and bagging the clothes, where did the evidence lead you next?
At this point, once we viewed the clothing and Mr. O'Keefe, we had to go talk to the last person that saw him, and that would have been, at the time, his girl.
Who'd you go see?
The defendant, Your Honor.
The prior question wasn't answered, so prior questions.
Did you know where Ms. Reed was at that point?
Yes, we had learned that she traveled to her parents' home in Dighton.
Did you learn about any or did you have any interest in any physical evidence at that point?
Yes. With the missing shoe, her stating that, did I hit him, and along that line of statements, I was interested in the vehicle that she was operating that night.
Okay. How far was Dighton from where you were at Good Samaritan Hospital?
Typically, I would say it's probably a 35-45 minute drive. With the driving conditions, it took us all of an hour, hour 15 minutes.
Who was driving?
I was driving.
Were you in a issued vehicle or were you in a personal vehicle?
No, I had to drive my personal pickup truck due to the weather. My cruiser would have never made the unplowed streets of the area.
Was Mr. Proctor with you?
He was.
Were you by his side the entire time?
Mr. Proctor and I were together the entire day.
You decided to go or drive towards Dighton. Did you ultimately make it to Dighton?
Yes, we did.
Do you know what time you arrived in Dighton approximately?
Approximately 3 p.m.
On your way down to Dighton, did you learn any further information beyond what you had known when you had left Mr. O'Keefe at Good Samaritan?
Yes. At one point, Michael Proctor took a call from Jen McCabe, and she further elaborated and provided information stating that she remembered.
Sustained.
After receiving that information, is there something specifically you wanted to look at when you got to Dighton?
Yes. We wanted to look at the rear right taillight. Based on the information provided, it was allegedly to
be... Let me stop you there. I just wanted to know what you wanted to look at.
Yes, sir.
I don't want to relate conversations of somebody who's not here. And so you had an interest in looking at the right rear taillight?
Yes.
Do you know what type of vehicle you were looking for?
We were looking for a large black Lexus SUV.
When you made your way down to Dighton, you said you finally arrived. How did you know you were at the right address?
The defendant provided her parents' address to us.
Before you got to Dighton, after learning of new information and the information you already had, did you make any arrangements?
Yes.
Tell the jury what you did on the way down to Dighton.
On the way down, we contacted Dighton Police Department and gave them a heads up that we would be coming down for an investigation, and we were looking to most likely seize a vehicle, and we were requesting their assistance in contacting a local tow truck company that they were contracted with, and or also to assist us at the scene being a uniformed presence.
When you pulled up to the address, did you make any immediate observations while you were still inside your truck?
Yes, the road was not well plowed. There was only enough clearance for one vehicle. So it was difficult to find place to park, and maneuverability was also challenging.
Did you make any observations of the home or the driveway before you got out of your truck?
Yes, the home is to the left of the driveway. The driveway was not plowed either. There was a large black Lexus SUV parked in the driveway.
Was the front of the SUV facing you or the back of the SUV?
The back of the SUV was closest towards us.
How far from the SUV were you when you first parked at that address?
Probably it's the length of the driveway. Based on my memory now, I would probably estimate it would be 60 feet or so.
Did you make any observations of the SUV from that distance?
It was covered with snow, like it's been either sitting outside or driven outside in the snow, so it was exposed to the elements.
What was your next steps?
We waited for Dighton PD to arrive to assist us. Once they arrived, Michael Proctor and I exited and proceeded up the driveway. I told Michael...
Let me stop you with what you said. I want to just know what you observed.
Okay.
As you're walking up the driveway, how close to that SUV did you get at its closest?
At its closest, I got as close as me and the defense table, which is probably 10 to 12 feet.
From the 10 to 12 feet, did you notice anything remarkable about the SUV?
Yes. There was a large piece of red taillight cover missing from the vehicle.
After you made an observation of a large piece of the red taillight cover missing, did you do anything else relative to the SUV at that time?
Yes, I told Michael to get close.
I'm not interested in what he did. What did you do? What did you see?
I just saw the damaged, missing taillight cover. I did not touch it. We did not approach it with physical contact. So,
did you see where Michael Proctor went?
Yes.
How close to the car did, or the vehicle did he get?
Within 3 feet.
Did he ever touch it?
No.
Where did you and Michael Proctor go next?
We proceeded to the front door of the home to make contact with the residents.
And how clearly did you see that missing piece? What's your level of certainty?
100%.
Did you knock on the door?
Yes, I did.
And were you invited in?
We were, but not through the front door due to the weather and the piled up snow. We couldn't open the storm door. Mr. Reed invited us into the home through the garage. He opened the garage door for us and welcomed us inside.
When you went inside, what did you see?
When I went inside, I saw Mr. Reed, Mrs. Reed, and the defendant sitting on the couch.
You've referred to the defendant a number of times as Ms. Reed. Do you see the defendant here in the courtroom today?
I do.
And the person you spoke to that morning, can you point that person out and describe an article of clothing they're wearing?
She's sitting in the middle right there in front of me wearing a black suit with yellow-colored metal buttons on it.
When you walked in, you said, did you say that the defendant was sitting on a couch?
She was.
How close were you when you were speaking to her?
Within 12, 15 feet. We were in the same room, in the living room area.
Was Mr. Proctor there?
He was.
Was Mr. Proctor speaking to her?
He was.
Were you speaking to her at the same time or interchanging?
We were both communicating with her, a team approach.
I want to ask you about that conversation you had with Ms. Reed. Before I do, Your Honor, may I approach briefly?
Okay. All right, so is it appropriate for me to give an instruction right now, Mr. Brennan?
I would defer to counsel.
Mr. Jackson, you want me to give a humane practice instruction?
Yes.
All right. So, folks, you're about to hear testimony regarding a statement or statements that were allegedly made by or attributed to Ms. Reed. I'm going to instruct you in more detail at the end of the case about this matter. However, I want you to understand that at this time, as the statements are offered into evidence, that before you may consider the content of any such statement made by the defendant as evidence, you're going to have to make a preliminary determination about whether or not it can be considered by you as evidence at all. In your determination at the end of the case, you're not to consider any such statement by the defendant as evidence, even though it's presented to you through a witness at trial, unless from all the evidence in the case you first determine that the Commonwealth has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Ms. Reed made the statements she's alleged to have made and that she made it voluntarily, freely, and rationally. All right, go ahead, Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sir, I want you to begin from when you were in the living room, your beginning conversation with the defendant, the presence of both her father and mother, you're with Mr. Proctor. Can you share with us the conversation that you had with the defendant?
Yes. She stated that she's willing to answer our questions, but she didn't want to go into too many details. That's how the conversation began. She provided us the fact that Mr. O'Keefe was hanging out with a friend of his at 5 p.m. at the One Meadows Ave residence, following which he proceeded to C.F. McCarthy's in Canton, where the defendant stated that she met him approximately at 9 p.m. She was drinking vodka sodas. Mr. O'Keefe was consuming Bud Light beer. After C.F. McCarthy's, they proceeded to the Waterfall Grill and Bar. At this point, the defendant was asked if she brought a beverage with her from C.F. McCarthy's to the Waterfall establishment, to which she stated she didn't think so. After the Waterfall, the defendant stated that she dropped Mr. O'Keefe off at 34 Fairview. She was asked if she saw him go in the house. She stated no, she did not see him go in the house. She was asked about the damage to her rear taillight, to which she stated, quote, "I don't know how I did it last night," end quote. Once she provided us with the fact that she dropped him off and never saw him go in the house, she was asked to provide details about her leaving. She stated that she made a three-point turn and left. She was asked to provide some explanation of how Mr. O'Keefe sustained those injuries that he had. She did not.
Let me stop you there. Did you get an answer to your question about how he sustained the injuries or the details about the three-point turn?
No, I did not.
You mentioned that when you were at Good Samaritan Hospital, you saw blood on the back of Mr. O'Keefe's head.
Yes.
Did you ask the defendant anything about that injury?
Yes. We asked about the injuries that Mr. O'Keefe had, that he had been displaying, and whether or not he had those injuries the night prior at either McCarthy's or Waterfall, to which the defendant stated she didn't see any injuries on him. But then she provided a statement saying that Mr. O'Keefe bumped his head two nights prior and asked her about it, which to me it seemed kind of strange, but.
Without the commentary.
Mm-hmm.
After she told you that Mr. O'Keefe had bumped his head two nights prior and that he had asked about it or she had asked about it?
She stated that he had bumped his head two nights prior and Mr. O'Keefe asked her about it.
Did she say when Mr. O'Keefe asked her about the bump on his head from the few nights before?
No, she did not.
Did the conversation conclude?
Yes, it did.
After the conversation concluded, what was your next step?
Once the conversation concluded, the defendant was advised that her vehicle is being seized and her cell phone was also seized.
Were there any other items at that point that you were seizing other than the cell phone and the vehicle?
Not from that location, no.
Did you have a warrant at that point?
We did not, no.
Did you have authority to seize items prior to having a warrant?
I'll allow that.
Well, what is the process when you want to obtain items but you don't have a warrant? What process do you go through?
We seize them to prevent any alteration, destruction of the evidence that could be contained on those items pending a warrant. They are secured. They're not touched or processed by us. The process of obtaining a warrant includes writing an affidavit justifying.
Objection.
Yeah, we don't need to hear any of this part.
Understood. Understood. Did you ultimately obtain both the phone and the vehicle?
Yes, we did.
Describe how the vehicle was seized. What happened?
The defendant provided her key card. It's like a credit card size key fob for the vehicle to allow the ignition to start. It was driven onto a flatbed tow truck, secured, and then we followed it from Dighton to the Canton Police Department.
Was video ever provided that showed part of that vehicle being loaded onto the tow truck?
Yes, it was.
Have you ever reviewed that video?
Yes, I did.
When you were at Dighton and the defendant's Lexus was being put on the tow truck, about what time was that?
It was approximately 4:16, 4:15 in the afternoon on the 29th of January, 2022.
Now, you mentioned that you took a cell phone. Are there parts or people, participants on the team that handle that specific type of evidence?
Yes, we have troopers that are specialized, trained, and have expertise in digital forensic analysis, extraction, and processing of digital devices.
Is that something you do?
I am trained in certain portions of it, but I am not an expert like them.
Did you manipulate the phone in any way?
No.
Did you see Mr. Proctor manipulate the phone in any way?
I don't recall seeing that, no.
Before the vehicle was moved or during the loading of the tow, did either you or Mr. Proctor go back anywhere near that vehicle?
We were near the vehicle once it was unloaded, but we never touched it.
Objection.
Okay. Jurors, I'm going to strike the last portion of that testimony.
From the point you went in and spoke to the defendant until the vehicle was placed in the back of the flatbed, did you ever go back near the vehicle and touch it in any way?
No.
Did you ever see Mr. Proctor go back near that vehicle and touch it in any way?
No.
You mentioned that the tow was loading the vehicle, the defendant's Lexus, around 4:15?
I believe so, yes.
Did you join the tow truck driver, or did you keep your separate vehicle at that point?
We traveled in my...
I'll allow it.
I drove my vehicle and followed the tow truck back to the Canton Police Department.
Where was Mr. Proctor?
In my front passenger seat.
During that time, had you made arrangements, or did you receive any information about other members of the team engaging in any searches relative to this case?
Yes, I have.
And what did you learn?
I learned that Detective Lieutenant Tully had...
I'm going to allow.
...had dispatched other members of our unit to 34 Fairview and other resources from the Massachusetts State Police to assist him in a search for the missing shoe.
Do you know what time those other members arrived or began to arrive at 34 Fairview?
Objection.
You begin your travels at 4:15 p.m. back to the Canton Police Department. Why did you choose to bring the vehicle to the Canton Police Department if the Canton police detectives were not working on this case anymore?
They had a heated storage facility, being the Sally Port. We needed to preserve the vehicle as best we could away from the elements. And it was also in close proximity to our office, also to process the vehicle and get the search warrant from the local courthouse would have been more convenient for us.
Why was a heated Sally Port or a heated garage important to you?
The vehicle was impacted with snow. that accumulated, and also from traveling on the highways, it was packed with a shell of snow covering the exterior of it. So it would melt away in a heated sally port.
Were you intending on having other resources or other team members or other units available to look at the vehicle at some point?
Yes, we were.
Who were you intending? Who did you expect would have to look at the vehicle in the future?
For one, we'd have to document the exterior of it with photographs. That would be crime scene services section. We would process it for fingerprints, which would be also service the crime scene services section provides. We would, if needed, take swabs for DNA or other latent evidence. So that would be the chemist, as well as if the authority was there to process the internal workings, the computer chips, and the infotainment system of the vehicle. And that would be a digital forensics expert that's trained in that field.
Would an unheated garage or sally port impede that?
Yes.
Given that Canton Police Department was not now part of the active investigation, did you have any concerns bringing it to the Canton Police Department?
No.
You said you left Dighton at 4:15. What time approximately did you and Mr. Proctor and that Lexus arrive at the Canton heated sally port garage area?
We arrived in at the Canton Police Department at 5:30, and the vehicle was unloaded and placed into the garage at 5:35 p.m.
Did you and Mr. Proctor go into the garage?
Yes, we did.
And in the garage, what were you doing?
We helped facilitate
I'm going to ask you what you were doing and then what you saw Mr. Proctor doing rather than use we. I want to be very specific about what you did and saw. What were you doing?
I helped put up yellow caution tape around the vehicle to prevent anyone from coming near it and touching it.
Were there any other persons in that area other than you and Mr. Proctor?
There were members of the Canton Police Department.
Did you make observations of the vehicle once you had it in that sally port area?
Yes, I did.
You mentioned that it was packed with snow. Was the snow still on it when you brought it into the sally port?
Yes, there was.
Did you wipe the car down or clear the car of the snow?
No.
Did you touch the vehicle in any way with your hands?
No.
Did you ever see Mr. Proctor touch that vehicle?
No, he did not.
Objection.
I'll sustain it. I'll strike that. Ask me a different one, Mr.
Did you ever see Michael Proctor touch that vehicle while you were in the sally port area?
I did not.
How long did you remain in the sally port area for, do you know?
We remained in the sally port area approximately until 5:51 and change, based on
the best
of my memory.
After you left the sally port area, where did you go?
We left the sally... I apologize.
Go ahead. If you can say first what you did and then wait for the next question, please, Sergeant.
I left the sally port area and proceeded inside the Canton Police Department.
Where was Mr. Proctor?
He was with me.
By your side?
Yes.
Did he ever leave your sight?
I'm sure at some point he walked away from me, but I can't. We were traveling together all day.
You went into a different part of the Canton Police Department?
Yes.
Where did you go?
Into the dispatch area, and then the conference room upstairs later on.
Why did you go up to the conference room?
The conference room was provided for us to use as a meeting location. The members of our unit that had assisted at the 34 Fairview Road scene had traveled back to Canton Police, and we were meeting there to share, exchange information based on what we had learned with our portions of the investigation. That way everyone's on the same page at that point.
Did you meet, is this team, is it called a CERT team?
There is a CERT team.
Do you know if the CERT team was the team that went to 34 Fairview?
Yes, I do.
Did you meet with the entire CERT team that night at the Canton Police Department or some members?
Not the entire team, no.
When you had the meeting in that room, who did you meet with?
In that room, I specifically remember being Detective Lieutenant Tully, myself, Michael Proctor, and other members of our homicide and narcotics section assigned to the Norfolk District Attorney's Office.
Did you discuss the evidence you had to that point?
Yes.
Regarding 34 Fairview Road, did you develop or decide any plans to physically go back to that area?
Yes, I did.
And what was the plan?
The plan was to take shovels and rakes and other gardening equipment and go back to that location to excavate for additional evidence.
When did you make the decision that you were going to go back to 34 Fairview?
It was that evening.
Why did you decide you were going to go back at some point?
During the recall of all the information learned and sharing of that information with other members of our investigative team, it was realized that Mr. O'Keefe was wearing a black baseball hat, and at this point in time, that article of clothing was still missing.
Was there something impeding a full and complete investigation of the scene?
At 34 Fairview?
Yes.
Yes, the heavy, large amount of snow that had accumulated over the last 12 hours or so heavily hindered our investigation of that immediate scene.
When you were debriefed, did you learn the area where the CERT team had spent most of their time searching?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, sir?
When you were debriefed, were you informed the area that the CERT team spent most of their time searching?
I don't recall on the specifics of it, no.
Okay. Now, at some point, did you obtain a registry of motor vehicle record and certificate for the Lexus that you had towed?
Yes, we did.
May I approach?
Yes.
So do you recognize this?
Yes, I do.
And if you can take a look at the following pages.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second. From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.